We're talking about the workplace and why, after decades of trainings and workshops and webinars, we still have a large gender imbalance when you look at the leadership ranks of many companies. Our next guest argues that the small, everyday biases can have large effects. Women's accomplishments are less often recognized, and they more often receive harsher punishment when they fail. So, she decided to try an experiment. She created a computer simulation of a company that included many of these biases that research has found that women deal with at work. And she found it doesn't take much bias for women to get behind. We're talking about unconscious bias today and how its real-world effects for women and minorities in the workplace. And we want to hear what you think. Have you experienced bias in the workplace? Are you a woman working in a male-dominated field? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us, Central Time WPR. We're speaking with science and culture journalist Jessica Nordell. Her new book is called The End of Bias, A Beginning, The Science and Practice of Overcoming Unconscious Bias. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Why did you want to study unconscious bias?
You know, it's a topic that I have been interested in for a really long time. I think my interest really started when I was kind of rudely awakened to its presence in my own career. I was a young journalist starting out in my 20s and trying to break into national magazines and national newspapers and not having a lot of luck. So one day I had a particular essay that I was trying to pitch to different publications and not getting a response. And it had a very narrow window of time that it was relevant for. So I kind of, in a moment of desperation, created a new email address and sent the essay out with the name J.D. Nordell instead of Jessica Nordell, thinking, well, maybe, you know, if I send it out under a man's name or an apparent man's name, I'll have a different response. And to my kind of shock, I didn't really think it was going to work, but it did. Like, the piece was accepted within hours, and it was the same piece as I had pitched under Jessica. And that really began my kind of rude awakening and fascination with the topic. And I've been studying it and writing about it ever since.
So to the same outlet, so the same pitch, the exact same story got approved when you submitted it under a different name, a more androgynous or masculine name?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
And so this book that you've written, you are trying to understand the science behind it. You wanted to get hard data on this kind of bias and how it actually affects women's careers. Tell us about, so you made this simulation, this computer simulation to try to model it. Tell us about how you did that.
Yeah, exactly. So when I was working on this project, I was really looking at, I was really looking for what the research says about how we tackle this problem, because there's copious research about the presence of unconscious or unintentional bias and discrimination sort of pervasively throughout so many different fields. We see it in healthcare, we see it in policing, we see it in the workplace, we see it in education. It's really all over the place. But what I wanted to do was, you know, in addition to look for evidence-based solutions, I wanted to understand kind of what the immensity of the problem was that we're dealing with. And if you look at gender bias, just narrowly, if you look at, for instance, gender bias in the workplace, one of the challenges is that when it's studied, it's typically studied kind of with like a snapshot approach. So studies will look at, for instance, they'll show sort of like the same resume with like a man's name and a woman's name, and then measure, you know, how much more likely someone is to prefer the resume with a man's name, something like that. But that's just like one instance. And the truth is, you know, we experience bias, anyone who experiences it repeatedly. It's not just like a one-time thing. So what I was really trying to figure out was, well, how do all of these momentary, fleeting experiences add up if you look at them over weeks, months, years, or a career? And that was something that I really couldn't find good longitudinal data on. So that's why I decided to create this computer simulation in partnership with a couple of computer scientists.
So how does it work? And what did you find?
Yeah, so the simulation basically is an artificial company that we created called, we call it Norm Corp. And it's a really simple company that we set up in computer code, which basically consists of employees, and they do projects either alone or in pairs. And then the projects either succeed or fail. And the successful projects, when an employee has a successful project, they get a boost in this score that we call the promotability score. And then twice a year, the employees with the top scores at every level get promoted. So it's pretty simple set of rules that are followed in this simulation. But what we did in the simulation was that we then kind of introduced a handful of the most common empirically validated kinds of gender bias that women experience in the workplace. So for instance, we know there's a lot of empirical data that shows that women's work is slightly devalued in relation to men's. So in our simulation, we had women who succeeded with solo projects get slightly less of a boost in their score than men. There's also a lot of research that shows that when women and men work together, women receive less credit than their male partner. So that was something we also factored into the simulation. We have occasional big projects that come along that have like outsized potential for boosts in scores. But as in the real world, in our simulation, women have to have had more past successes in order to be assigned those projects. So there are about a half a dozen different biases that we introduced into the simulation, and then we basically watched what happened over time. And it was pretty alarming to see what happened. I mean, what we found was that you only needed a very, very small amount of bias in order to show really big disparities over 10 years, which was the period of time that we simulated for. So in our simulation, if you only devalue women's work by about 3% with relation to men, over a 10-year set of promotion cycles, you end up with a workplace where the top level is 87% men. So I think one of the most stark findings, I mean, there were a lot of stark findings, but one of them was just how little bias you actually need to have a huge disparity if it's frequently applied.
Yeah, so what you're pointing out is that maybe after the years of headlines of Me Too and a lot of folks maybe thinking, you know, maybe it's big events or toxic managers or big things that are happening to drive out women or drive out other marginalized groups in the workplace, you're actually suggesting, and your data has shown that actually it can be an accumulated kind of compounding effect of really small differences over time.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, what we found was that in our simulation, it was actually the small biases that happen frequently that had a much bigger effect on disparities than biases that had a large effect, like our stretch projects we thought were going to have a really big effect. But it was actually the accumulation of really small biases that had the biggest effect. And it's, you know, it's really tricky because one of the things that inspired me to do this simulation was looking at how difficult it is for gender discrimination lawsuits to actually succeed, because juries are looking for that one kind of smoking gun, you know, like just what you said, you know, the hideous manager who does outrageous things, or like a really strong discriminatory policy. But that's not necessarily what's actually affecting most women. What's affecting most women is this kind of slow and steady buildup of small differences that ultimately creates a very large impact over time.
We're talking with Jessica Nordell about her new book, The End of Bias, A Beginning. She's telling us about how unconscious bias affects women in the workplace and ultimately how successful their careers are. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz. Right now we're talking with Jessica Nordell, author of The End of Bias, A Beginning. We're talking about unconscious bias and how it affects our workplaces. You can join in, 1-800-642-1234. Have you ever been to an unconscious bias training or anti-harassment training at your workplace? Do you think it was effective? Did you learn anything new? Share with us, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, ideas@wpr.org. So, Jessica, in your research, what have you found to be effective strategies for identifying and rooting out bias in the workplace?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think a lot of organizations look to trainings as kind of a silver bullet solution. Like, we can, you know, bring in a consultant and do a couple hour training and that will solve the problem. And the challenge with those trainings is that they're rarely evaluated. So we don't necessarily know if they're making things better or worse or not having any effect at all. They also can kind of create the appearance of change without creating actual change. So actual change is challenging. I mean, it requires a lot of work. It requires leaders saying, you know, it's not a matter of if there's bias in our organization, but where and how. And then it takes really systematically looking at all of the places where bias can enter into decision making, from hiring to promotion decisions to the assigning of projects to even questions about, you know, who gets to speak in meetings, who gets various, you know, opportunities thrown their way. And then, you know, sort of systematically trying to ameliorate those. And there are, you know, there are different approaches that do work. Things like standardizing criteria for hiring can be really helpful. Standardizing criteria for making promotion decisions and making those really transparent. Because one thing that often happens in organizations is the criteria for getting a promotion are kind of vague or unwritten or kind of amorphous, and therefore the goalposts can constantly be shifting. And for women or people from other marginalized groups, people from racial or ethnic minorities or people with disabilities, those goalposts can constantly shift, and that can be extremely, you know, frustrating and unfair and lead to a very biased workplace and ultimately, you know, a really unfair workplace. So those are some of the approaches that can work. But, you know, ultimately in my research, I would say what I found to be most essential was the mindset of the leaders. Like, if the leaders are really committed and really see diversity and the, you know, welcoming of all people's ideas and potential, if the leader sees those as really essential to the organization, that really makes a big difference.
We're going to go to the phones now. We have a caller for you, Jessica. We have Tim in Madison who's got a question. Good afternoon, Tim.
I guess I have more of a comment than a question.
Sure.
I own several businesses, and usually my role is to start them, and then my wife usually takes over. And I can tell you from firsthand experience the discrimination that happens. For example, we'll be closing a deal. My wife is obviously in charge of all of it. And they'll go around and shake every person's hand that is male and not shake my wife's hand.
Wow.
And it happens all the time. It's unbelievable.
Thanks for sharing with us, Tim, your experience.
That's really interesting, Tim. And I wonder, Tim, if you would have if you would have believed that, if you hadn't, you know, seen it with your own eyes.
Well, I see it all the time now because
right.
I know what to look for.
Jessica, is that something that you saw echoed as you talked to people who were trying to grapple with it in their companies, in their workplaces?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is, it's challenging because I think, you know, each of us only has our own experience to go from. So if Tim were going into those meetings just by himself and people were shaking his hand, he would never know that this could be happening to his wife. But I think, yeah, I think it actually does take sort of seeing it sometimes, you know, seeing the difference between how people are treated to make this reality really clear and obvious for people.
So Jessica, what do you recommend companies do I know we only have a moment left with you, but if you had one takeaway for those with decision-making power in companies, what would you recommend?
I would say first, it's really a matter of asking not if, but how and where bias is present. And then once you take a look and identify those places, really systematically look at how it might be possible to standardize decision making and take a little bit more discretion out of the individual and relocate that to a more sort of objective set of standards for making decisions. That's a really good place to start.
Well, that is all the time we have. It went by so fast. Thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We've been speaking with science journalist Jessica Nordell. Her new book is called The End of Bias, A Beginning. Now, Wisconsin law enforcement agencies have had difficulty recruiting officers for years. The national reckoning last year over racial justice and calls for police reform only added to agencies' struggles. As Danielle Kading reports, the pandemic, rising violence, and intense scrutiny of police have made it more challenging to attract and keep officers.
Lauren Phillips remembers watching with her police academy classmates in Eau Claire this past spring as they waited for a verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. She says what Chauvin did was wrong and they wanted justice to be served.
Everyone was anxious. Everyone was hoping that the right thing would come about. But at the same time, we're all sitting there like, what happens if this goes south? We were still recruits in the academy, but we still wore shirts that said like CBTC law enforcement.
Phillips and fellow students would change their shirts or grab a jacket before going out in public. Officers have faced intense outrage and criticism since Chauvin murdered George Floyd last May, igniting worldwide protests calling for police accountability. The negative attitudes toward police didn't sway Phillips. Now on patrol for Superior Police, she wants to bring more respect to law enforcement.
And they will remember you, and they will remember the things that you do. So it's one
here,
of those things to take into... It's just one of those things to be cognizant of when you are out in the community.
But it's getting harder to attract people like Phillips. A national survey of nearly 200 police departments found hiring dropped while retirements rose 45% and resignations climbed by 18% from April of last year to this spring. Executive Director Jim Palmer with the Wisconsin Professional Police Association says the pandemic and intense scrutiny have made it more challenging to draw and keep officers.
There are more options for younger people today that pay better and don't require them to put their lives and their personal safety at risk and that don't carry the significant enhanced scrutiny.
Massive protests unfolded in Milwaukee and Madison last year with calls to defund police. In Milwaukee, retirements among Milwaukee police spiked nearly 40% last year, with 131 officers calling it a career. In the last 5 years, more than 500 Milwaukee cops have retired. In an interview with the city's Fire and Police Commission, acting Milwaukee Police Chief Jeffrey Norman says the loss of officers is a challenge.
And so we need to have, again, something that we have not had in a long time. A consistency of a transition of when those particular type of individuals move on, are we able to continue to lift without having a blip on the radar?
Under the next budget, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett is proposing to use COVID-19 stimulus funds to train 195 new officers next year.
Overall, the total strength of the department will be on average 1,657, not quite keeping pace with retirements.
In Madison, the number of applicants for this year's recruit class dropped by nearly 44%. The Police Association's Palmer thinks investment in community policing is crucial to building trust between officers and communities they serve. Megan Stroshine is an associate professor of criminology and law studies at Marquette University. She says more community policing would be a step in the right direction.
If we can improve the relationship between the police and the public, policing will become a more attractive position.
But Marquesa Tucker-Harris with the African American Roundtable says Milwaukee police have been talking about community policing for a long time, and she doesn't see it making a difference. She's been pushing for cuts to police budgets. She says taxpayer money should be shifted away from law enforcement to support housing assistance and other programs to address the root causes of poverty and violence.
What we do know is what we've been doing isn't working. And we can't continue to waste money. We can't continue to allow lives to continue to be destroyed and lost.
The number of homicides had been falling in recent years across Milwaukee, but killing spiked during the pandemic last year with a record 190 homicides. The city is on track to break that record this year as police staffing in Milwaukee hits a record 20-year low. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I'm Molly Stentz. You're listening to Central Time.